Constantinople/Late Medieval Europe. Operation. Antwerp Witch Recruitment. Deed. Retrieve and carry viable Kalonji seeds across Europe for sowing. DTAP. Pera, Constantinople, September 1202. Paird's Bosphorus, Antwerp, Belgium, November 1202. Strand. First, out of a projected 3, repetition of this deed. Erzabeth sent Doer Felix Dorn from Odek No. 2 at 8:10 of day 627. Doer landed safely in Pera, retrieved Kalonji seeds without incident, traveled for 2 months by foot, river, and stolen horse from Constantinople to Belgium. Many adventures. Did not die. Arrived in Paird's Bos Forest, sowed Kalonji seeds, was homed by Hurdele, our KCW of that DTAP. Note. Witch Rachel in Pera volunteered for diachronic engagement, but father disapproved. Dutifully submitted, Dr. Melisande reads less Nora Roberts than Dr. Blevins does, Stokes.
Internal memo. From Dr. Roger Blevins to General Octavian Frink, re Melisande Stokes, day 688, 1412. General Frink, redacted.
Internal memo. From Lieutenant Colonel Tristan Lyons to General Octavian Frink, re Dr. Blevins' recent statements, re Melisande Stokes, day 688, 1502. Dear General Frink, redacted.
Internal memo. From Dr. Roger Blevins to General Octavian Frink, re Lieutenant Colonel Lyons's response to my somehow leaked memo, re Dr. Stokes, day 688, 1539. Aki, redacted.
Internal memo email. From General Octavian Frink to Dr. Roger Blevins and Lieutenant Colonel Tristan Lyons. Re leaked memos, etc. Day 689, 1019. Redacted. Coming from an academic background, Dr. Blevins, you should know better than to consign anything to writing. I will have to redact most of this correspondence, not due to security concerns, but from sheer embarrassment. So, you will let it rest there, gentlemen. General O.K. Frink.
Post by Felix Dorn on Recreation Odin Channel. Day 617.
As some of you have noticed, I am not much of a talker, but I just wanted to mention that if anyone wants to join a barefoot running group, meet me at 0430 tomorrow at the Harvard Bridge on the Cambridge side.
Reply from Lieutenant Colonel Tristan Lyons, day 619.
Well, everyone, maybe this isn't much of a surprise, but response has been muted to Felix's Dawn Barefoot Running Group. Heavy spring rains, darkness, and muddy conditions have been cited as an excuse. I just wanted to remind everyone that when you are sent, you arrive naked, which means barefoot. Your feet are probably larger than average for the DTAP, so stealing shoes isn't as easy as people make it sound. And we do prefer nighttime arrivals because there's less chance of being noticed. Participation in Felix's Dawn Barefoot Running Group is a breeze by comparison, and will help you develop skills, grow calluses, and build up a tolerance to pain that will serve you well when sprinting away from an unsecured DTAP, or, worse yet, getting clear of a possible diachronic shear event. Cardio. It's not just for knights.
Dodo Memorandum. Critical Upgrade to Job Titles by Macy Stoll, MBA. Posted 02-11-45, day 629.
As those of you in management positions are already aware, it is essential that we move over to ISO 9000 compliant job titles for all current and future Dodo staff. It is beyond the scope of this memo to enumerate all of the benefits that will accrue to Dodo and, by extension, the taxpayers as a result of organization-wide ISO 9000 compliance, but But those of you who are curious can find plenty of information about it on the non-classified Internet. Making this especially urgent is that we are getting pushback from concerned parties in the trapezoid about having a staff member whose job title is witch. The word simply looks bad when it shows up in a spreadsheet or official report. Moreover, since it is gender-specific, it is a violation of our diversity policy. Or at least it will be when that policy is written. It's time to nip this in the bud, since it will only become that much worse when, slash if, we recruit more staff to perform the same function. After lengthy consultations with Dr. Oda and others, we have settled on a new job title, which has been fast-tracked through the Policy on Official Jargon and Acronym Coinage. That title is, drumroll, MUON, for Multiple Universe Operations Navigator. We believe that this acronym encapsulates the essential functions and duties of this all-important role without any of the backward and sexist connotations that have raised hackles within the trapezoid. Later on, we may establish additional gradations such as Junior MUON, Senior MUON, etc. But for now, this is unnecessary as we only have one of them on payroll. This title applies only to paid staff members living in our timeline. Terms such as KCW may still be employed when referring to individuals in past or alternate timelines.
Exchange of posts by Dodo staff on Recruiting Odin Channel. Post from Lieutenant Colonel Tristan Lyons, Day 630.
I've been reading Stokes's after-action reports on Hera's Blaherne Palace deed, and I want to start a conversation about Varangian guards. For those of you who might not be up to speed on context, these are fighting men from Scandinavian or other northern European countries who were recruited to serve as palace guards and elite troops by the Byzantine Empire. I had read of them in history books, so I knew of their existence, but reading these after-action reports really drives home how pervasive their presence was in Constantinople circa 1200. Best of all, they tend to show up in important places like the Imperial Palace and key fortifications like the Galata Tower, city gates, etc. Why is this of interest to Dodo? Well, it's no secret that we are having difficulty recruiting doers capable of blending in 1200 Constantinople. The required combination of physical appearance, cultural literacy, and language fluency needed to pass in that DTAP is difficult to pull off, occasional miracle recruits like Hera notwithstanding. The ubiquitous presence of Varangian guards suggests a different strategy, at least for male doers. Don't worry about trying to pass as a native Byzantine. Instead, hide in plain sight. We can recruit doers who can pass for northern Europeans, then send them back and look for ways to infiltrate them into Varangian guard units. Their lack of fluency in the Greek language, ignorance of contemporary customs and etiquette, etc., then becomes a natural fit with their cover story. This strategy presents two main challenges that I can think of. One, we don't know much about how the Varangian guards were actually recruited. If we're lucky, there's a sort of labor market in this DTAP, such that big, healthy-looking northern European males, who show up in town with no past history or connections, can get recruited into these units without going through the Byzantine equivalent of a background check. Now that Hera is finished with the Kalanji seed deeds, and has established some familiarity with Constantinople, maybe we can send her on some scouting missions to learn more about how this works. 2. Even if it works for a doer to show up in Constantinople from parts unknown, with no connections or background, he's not going to be able to pass for a Varangian guard unless he speaks the language. Leading to the question, what is the language that these guys speak, and where can we learn it? Stokes?
Response from Dr. Melisande Stokes, Day 630.
Tristan, the Varangian guards were drawn from all over Scandinavia, Northern Europe, and Britain over a span of centuries. So it depends. In our era, 1203, The majority were speaking Anglo-Saxon, but some of the ones Hira encountered were apparently speaking Norman, which is a transitional dialect, not a stable language as we normally think of it. As you probably know, the Vikings invaded France, were bought off with Normandy, settled there, then used it as a base for invading Britain and many other places. The most badass Normans crossed the Channel with William the Conqueror. The ones that stayed behind in Normandy spawned the generations who mostly enjoyed jousting and courtly love, etc. This, plus Normans and Anglo-Saxons obviously detesting each other, equals surprising to find Normans in the 1203 Anglo-Saxon-centric Varangian Guards. But actually, we can use it to our advantage. If we train doers to speak Anglo-Saxon, they will probably blend in just fine, no matter their accent. But they do run some risk of being called out. Anglo-Saxon had a limited geographical spread, and thus a limited number of dialects, most of which are probably represented in the 1203 VG cohort. Someone speaking an eccentric variation might arouse curiosity. Small chance, but a chance. However, variations of Norman were spoken from Greenland to the Volga and from Sicily to the Arctic Circle. If Normans were accepted into the VG, then a doer could learn any kind of mashup passing as some variant of Norman and never run the risk of being called out for lack of fluency. They can just claim they're from some other clan over the mountain. There would be too many variations of the language and too few native speakers and residents for anyone to get wise.
From Dr. Blevins, Day 631.
I have been monitoring this exchange with some interest. Lieutenant Colonel Lyons's idea seems to merit further development. Lieutenant Colonel Lyons, please see me about deploying Hira Yassin on scouting missions to Constantinople so that we can better understand procedures for recruiting Varangian guards. I only wish that she were less conspicuous. Can we put her in a burqa? There must have been some Muslim presence in the city in that era. Dr. Stokes, the obvious failure mode in your linguistic analysis for Norman or Anglo-Saxon is that our doer, claiming to be a native of some specific region, might happen to cross paths with another Varangian guard who actually was from the exact same location and who would detect faults in our doer's accent, knowledge base, etc., and become suspicious. Agreed, less likely with Norman than with Anglo-Saxon, but not impossible. We can minimize the chances of that happening by developing a cover story according to which our doer is from an exceptionally remote and obscure part of the Norman world. Please move this to the top of your priority list.
Dodo Report. Potential KCWs, Normandy, 12th Century. By Melisande Stokes, Ph.D. Submitted to Odin Archive, Day 645.
Objective. Identify potential known compliant witches, KCWs, in remote settlements in Normandy during the approximate span 1050 to 1200 as a preliminary step toward establishing a DTAP there slash then. Propose function of that DTAP? To serve as language camp for fighter-class doers, giving them linguistic and cultural proficiency needed to pass as Norman Varangian guards in the 1200 Constantinople DTAP. General background. Normandy in this era had been colonized by transplants from both Scandinavia and Anglo-Saxon Danish-influenced regions of Britain for well over a century. It had not yet been incorporated into France, but had been expanding its borders at France's expense for some time. The linguistic environment was accordingly complicated and fluid. The population was largely Christianized, at least in name, nobility very much so by 1200. Since most were illiterate, essentially all of the available records fall into three categories. The first two are, 1, legal record, and 2, chronicles slash accountings kept by the feudal lord's stewards, but these rarely refer to women independently of their marital status. The more fruitful source, therefore, is church documents, typically written by priests, friars, etc. in Latin, or, less frequently, medieval French. Methodology. Review medieval church documents for points of convergence per following criteria. A. References to heretical leanings per church fathers. B. Family trees, featuring illegitimate but non-ostracized daughters over the course of several generations. C. Recorded activity suggestive of magic, particularly pertaining to crops, livestock, weather, and ease of pillaging nearby adversaries. And D. Perceived nonconformity in local female individuals, especially those as found in B above. Result. Potential KCW, Tira of Colonnae. A. And in June of this year, 1027, was Tira delivered of a girl child of no known sire, as Tira herself had been 22 summers earlier, and her mother, Wilmetta, before her. And yet was Emma the aunt of Tira joyful to receive Tira and her bastard child to her hearth, and the child was christened Beatrice. Ref 2876. B. And in April of this year, 1046, was Tira again deprived of those villainous and satanic objects with which she adorns her cousin's chamber, and scorned to replace them with an image of our Lord? For this she was given a penance of 10 Hail Marys, which she was loath to perform, but said she would rather receive a lash, at which the priest hastily did declare her free of all sin. Ref 3486. C. And in this month, August 1050, did Tira of Herblore cause great sorrow upon the mayor of the village of Colonnae and the lord of illegible for her scolding at their crossing her when she wished to forage upon their lands for select herbs? D. And in this month, January 1061, died Tira of Herblore, and the valley wept at her passing for fear of the famine returning that they credited her for keeping at bay. Ref 6584. Further research recommended, as incidental accounts in 1002 and throughout the 1100s suggest an uninterrupted lineage of witches in Tira's family, all with strong local and familial authority. Recommended search words: 1137, Colonnae, Maneld, 1191, 1192, and 1195, Colonnae, Rikilde, and 1193 and 1197, Colonnae, Imlin.
Exchange of posts between Dr. Roger Blevins and Dr. Melisande Stokes on Private Odin Channel. Day 650, mid-May, Year 2. Post from Dr. Blevins.
Dr. Stokes, I am hereby directing you to proceed with the recruitment of the potential KCW known as Tira, circa 1045. As much as we need your energies behind the expansion of the Diachronic Operative Resource Center, it is clear that you are the best qualified of our existing roster of doers to undertake this mission. And so I suggest that you delegate some of your present responsibilities to others as you undertake the necessary training. Macy Stoll is an obvious candidate to shoulder routine administrative and managerial tasks, and has expressed a willingness to do so.
Response from Dr. Stokes.
Understood. As busy as I am here, I can't dispute that I would be the best person to act as forerunner in this DTAP, barring some recruiting breakthrough in the next couple of weeks. I anticipate that getting up to speed on local languages and customs will occupy me for most of the summer, with the actual deed slated for August. Meanwhile, Ersovic can be putting in the usual research needed to send me to that DTAP, with reasonable temporal and positional accuracy. One thing about your message surprised me, and so I wanted to double-check to make sure there was no misunderstanding. You specified Tira 1045 as the target of the operation. This means that our doers would be learning a dialect of Norman and a set of customs that would be 150 years out of date by the time they show up in Constantinople, circa 1200. My research indicates that Tira's descendant, Imblin, is also a witch. I propose we have a higher chance of success in this endeavor if we send our Varangian guards to 1190's colony to study with Imblin. They will stand a better chance of both comprehending and being comprehended if they've got 1200 Norman French.
From Dr. Blevins.
Thanks for your illuminating feedback. For classified reasons, 1045 works better for us than the 1190s do. Assuming language immersion will indeed work for Tristan, let's send him back there ASAP.
From Dr. Stokes.
What are classified reasons? How could they be so classified that neither Tristan, the probable doer in question, nor myself, the linguistic historian expressly in charge of determining these matters, is being told about them? Can we CC in General Frink and Dr. Oda to this thread, in case they can shed light on either chronotropic or top-level strategic reasons for not doing the sensible thing here?
From Dr. Blevins.
Mel, thank you as always for your spirited commentary. There is no need to trouble either General Frink or Dr. Oda in this case. The answer is straightforward. Training our Varangian guard candidates close to the time of the Constantinople DTAP is dangerous because, however remote their hometown, they could still be recognized. That is why to choose a spot not only temporally but also geographically isolated from 1200 Constantinople. Other issues in this decision are above your pay grade, so you don't need to know.
Dodo Memorandum. Clarification to Dress Code by Macy Stoll, MBA. Posted 02-11-45, day 653.
The distribution of Dodo's newly minted dress code has brought in a flood of requests for clarification. Until such time as this document can be reworded, here is a useful rule of thumb. Doers on active missions are exempt from all dress code provisions, including the requirement to wear anything at all.
Letter from Grania to Grace O'Malley. Winter Solstice, 1601.
Auspiciousness and prosperity to you, milady. I pray your grace will forgive my few months of silence, for wasn't it in a terrible way I found myself trying to secure safety and security after the disaster of the Loma? Rose, it was, sent Tristan Lyons back to his era, and wasn't I glad to see the back of him for a while? But only for a while, Your Majesty, for I've landed on my feet, and determined I am to learn the truth behind what Tristan be up to. When he told me everything, truly 'twasn't everything at all, or else why would that right arse Les Holgate appear and make such a muck of everything? There are things going on in the future, and it's to do with magic, and 'tis the least Tristan Lyons can do but be fully honest with me at last, now that he and his like have robbed me of all I cherish in London. But, as I said, it's safety I've found for myself, and at the merest cost. I've told Your Majesty in years past of Francis Bacon's Society of Good Pens. 'Tis a pun on the male member is what I'm thinking, given what I know of Sir Francis. This group meets at Gray's Inn, and composed of the brightest of menfolk it is, them being intelligencers and counterfeiters, not to mention secretaries, physicians, poets, theologians, apothecaries, and the occasional natural philosopher. And of these last few, doesn't Sir Francis love to debate with the nature of the universe, in ways that seem like conversations witches might have with each other, if witches were wont to waste their time putting into words things which go without saying. There are no witches in their discourses, and indeed no women at all. Like a bunch of turtles trying to discuss flight they remind me of, and not getting all of it correct neither. But sure, it's entertainment enough. Don't I keep my mouth shut when I'm near them and pour the ale? They are the best minds in London, and one of them natural philosophers with a mystical bent, one Jacques Cardigan, a mad enough fellow with a mad enough name, has taken me in as a servant, and your ladyship will understand that I warm his bed when he asks for me, but it's an easier life than posing as a bawd, so it is. Himself is a wealthy enough fella, although an obvious Catholic. What with a French name, and his surname coming from a Catholic shire in Wales, he can hardly hide it, can he? So he keeps out of politics, and that may in the end mean I must move on to other quarters, for to be of use to your grace. But for now, it's safety and security and no questions asked. Sure, he thinks he's landed in it. Here's a pretty Irish refugee who will give him pleasure in exchange for room and board, and not be questioning his religion neither. He's a summer house in Surrey, in Norwich, and we'll be retiring there come spring, if I'm still under his roof then. But through winter, we're near enough to graze in. Rose knows my circumstances, and conveyed them to Tristan. So I've let him know I'm pleased to continue to help him knot his network of witches, and it seems to have grown with breathtaking speed, so it has. I've stopped asking him questions directly, though, and it's trying to learn a bit by observation I am now, for it seems to me that he knows precisely what it is that brought magic to its knees, and it seems to me that if I might know it too, I might hoist him by his own petard, to quote that poxy playwright. I could be using his own strategy of moving around through time and space, not to bring back magic, but to prevent its cessation in the first place. I've no idea how to make that so, and it's cagey enough he's being with his information, but I've naught else to do with my time now that I'm away from Whitehall circles, so I mean to figure it out. The one thing I'm knowing for certain is that in his ever-expanding fellowship of witches, Tristan occasionally runs into an ornery one who needs to be coaxed into the congregation, and sure, why shouldn't they? I would have been demanding some coaxing if I didn't foolishly think I could benefit from him as much as him from me. At this moment of time, himself and some other doers are romping about the universe trying to please some wending woman in Antwerp who lived some 50 years back and who had some connection to that banker fellow Gresham, and therefore, somehow or other, to my new friend Bacon. For didn't Sir Thomas Gresham's bastard daughter marry Sir Francis's half-brother? Is right she did. And of course I'm sure the fuggers are involved in all of this somehow. They always are. Truth be told, I don't even know if I should be taking the side of Tristan. What does he need do in Antwerp 50 years back, especially requiring magic? Was there something about that time and place that contributed to the corruption of magic? And why make use of a witch who knew the forebears of the menfolk I now brush elbows with? A pure coincidence, is it? Or with his future knowledge, does Tristan plan to make use of me somehow, and my new friends? So many questions, Your Grace. So it's learning about all that I intend to do, but not so's Tristan would notice my efforts. In fact, I intend to make myself excessively useful to him, in the hopes that he includes me in his confidences. Perhaps even finds cause to have me sent to his own time. Then I can see for myself what's what. He's a grand lad, when he's not scheming on behalf of his overlords, and I've a fondness for him, so I do. With all good wishes to ye, milady, Gronya, formerly of London.
Dodo Human Resources Personnel Dossier. Family name, Overkleeft. Given names, Esme Clare. Title, Doctor, PhD, Bioinformatics. Age, 34. Class, Closer, MacGyver. Height, 5 feet 10 inches. Eyes, blue. Hair, chestnut. Complexion, light, freckled. Distinctive features, crooked nose, bent left clavicle, results of sports injuries. Ethnicity, Northern European. Nationality, Belgian. Language fluency ratings, Dutch, French, 5. English, Walloon, 4. German, 3. Religion, atheist, from historically Catholic family on mother's side, historically Dutch Reformed Church on father's. Citizenship, Belgian, EU. Biography. From an academic family that moved among various university towns, mostly low countries, while she was growing up. States that this nomadic lifestyle forced her to acquire social skills she might otherwise have neglected, given a generally introverted intellectual personality. Participated in various sports, with emphasis in field hockey and track and field. Hobby, sewing and textiles. Attended University of Antwerp, majored in biology. While at school, became involved in local chapter of Society for Creative Anachronism, with emphasis on making period-correct clothing. Later obtained Ph.D. in bioinformatics, focusing on plant biology, from Leiden. Obtained security clearance and thereby found her way into Defense Department personnel databases as a result of a NATO project to design upgraded military camouflage patterns in response to projected botanical shifts resulting from climate change. When approached by Dodo, was in London seeking investors in an apparel startup that was a spin-out of the camouflage project. Agreed to put that project on ice in order to accept the Dodo job. Skill set. Athletic, hardy, uncomplaining, with a winning personality and ability to adapt to various social milieus. Keen eye for clothing, textiles, needlework of the late medieval early Renaissance era. Exceptionally strong knowledge of botanical matters, especially in northern Western Europe. Limitations. Her unusual height will make her conspicuous, particularly in medieval populations.
After action report. Debriefer. Dr. Melisande Stokes. Doer. Dr. Esme Overkleeft. Closer. Theater. Near. Northern Europe Early Renaissance. Operation. Antwerp Witch Recruitment. Part C. Harvest Kalonji as incentive to potential KCW, Winifred Dutton. Deed. Recruit Dutton as KCW. DTAP. Paradsbos Forest, Antwerp, Belgium, 1562. Note. A previous unsuccessful recruitment attempt had been made by Dr. Stokes circa day 500. The encounter ended awkwardly. Dutton had demanded Kalonji, which Stokes knew nothing about. So recruitment was abandoned until a new gambit could be established for obtaining some. The series of deeds conducted by Hira Yassin and Felix Dorn, circa 1200, had the effect of sowing Kalonji in known locations in the Paradsbos Forest, where conditions were ripe for it to thrive and remain available centuries in the future. Thanks to the earlier deeds by Dr. Stokes, Winifred Dutton was already aware of us, and Overkleeft knew how to obtain clothes, make contact with Dutton, etc. Muon Ersebet Karpati sent Dr. Overkleeft from Odek No. 3, at 8:21 of day 818. Having retrieved clothes dashed from Stokes's previous efforts, Overkleeft went without incident to Fortress, at which Doer Felix Dorn had sowed seeds in 1202. Discovered that, 360 years later, a small but hardy patch of Kalonji had survived in one south-facing exposed courtyard. Esme uprooted one plant and took samples of leaves, removing viable roots and seed buds, so that Dutton could not simply establish her own patch of Kalonji. Carried these to the home of Winifred, wife of Thomas Dutton, Thomas Gresham's Antwerp factor. It is now known, and was an open secret even then, that Winifred had been married off to Dutton only to get her out of England, where she had been Thomas Gresham's lover, and had borne him a natural daughter, Anne, 12 years old at time of this deed. Consequently, Dutton was living in a comfortable home with a disinterested spouse in a foreign country, deprived of her lover, and except for the task of raising her daughter was very restless. She allowed the servants to bring Esme into the home at once and was delighted to receive the Kalonji plant, the merits of which she immediately began to describe to both Esme and young Anne. Without further obstinacy, she pledged herself to being a KCW and made her residence available as a safe house. Furthermore, she encouraged her daughter to do so as well, which Anne agreed to eagerly. Esme Overkleeft returned without incident at 1845. Note: it is already marked in Dodo archives, but for ease of reference, here is additional historical context. Not told to Winifred or Anne, of course. Anne Gresham / Dutton will go on to marry Nathaniel Bacon, half-brother of Sir Francis, with whom she will live in Norwich, England. Her three daughters, all witches, are roughly contemporaneous with Grania in London. Accordingly, our next deed will be to reach out to them for recruitment. Diachronicle, circa December year 2, in which Tristan has a working vacation. The village of Colinay straddles a tributary of the River Dive, which empties into the English Channel a few miles downstream. The actual D-tap was a copse of trees, both leafless and evergreen, some half-mile from the center of the village proper. Dodo now had a small operational group called TAST, the Tactical Archaeological Strike Team. As the name implied, they combined the skill set of traditional archaeologists, digging holes and finding stuff, with those of covert intelligence operatives. They knew how to get in and out of potentially hostile locations without drawing attention, and how to find what they were looking for in a hurry. You might not think of Normandy as a hostile location, but because of France's ancient and secret laws banning diachronic operations, it was hostile to us. Anyway, TAST, zeroing in on a powerful glamour centered on this copse of trees, had been able to carry out a couple of midnight digs and verify that it had been the home site of the lineage of presumed witches we'd seen mentioned in various church documents. It was classic witch real estate, close enough to the village to allow commerce and social contacts, but sufficiently remote to afford separation and privacy. Ersebeth was admirably on the mark. I materialized, unobserved, right at the copse, where the ground was mercifully dry, and after recovering from the usual disorientation, I followed the scent of wood smoke to a hut, some 50 very chilly strides away, the home of our potential KCW, Tira of Colinay. I had landed by design in late afternoon in midwinter. In spite of the risk of hypothermia, I elected to arrive now, because Tira would likely be holed up in front of her fire. As we'd come to expect, Tira, a handsome woman of some 40 years, brown hair gently graying, was not surprised by the arrival of a naked stranger, although I cannot say she was particularly pleased by it either. She grudgingly allowed me to enter her hut and warm myself by the fire. She muttered to herself, "Pardon? Please repeat," I said politely in Latin, the educated traveler's language of the time. Tira appraised me a moment, then turned back to the fire.
"I said,"
now in slightly stiff Latin,
"I sense the glamour in recent days, but I did not expect somebody sent. I cannot imagine why anyone wants to visit such a remote location."
"Would this language be easier?" I asked in Anglo-Saxon. She gave me a confused look. "Let it be Latin, then," I hastily amended. "Are you fluent?"
"Too fluent for the priest's liking," she said with a reluctant little chuckle. "If you speak slowly, I can probably understand."
I was able to convey to Tira our proposal, namely that young men, apparent warriors, would come and stay with her from time to time, with no other purpose than to become familiar with the local language and customs. They would be disciplined and well-behaved. After a few weeks, she would home them.
"Bah,"
she said, turning her attention back into the fire.
"I do not like young men. Why not send young women?"
"The men could be your house help while they are here," I said, looking around. "Chop firewood and bring it in. Fetch water. Fix that leak.
I added, pointing. Is that roof beam rotting? Do you think it's safe to wait until spring? What kind of snow load do you get here? With a dismissive wave of her hand, she grunted.
I have magic for all of that.
Magic can be tiring, I said. If the young men were here, you could rest all the time. Order them around. Tira made an exaggerated expression of, maybe I should think about this after all. And after a moment, nodded her head.
You say they are warriors?
I nodded.
I have no weapons for them, only some small knives and an axe for the chopping of wood.
They are not here to act as warriors, I clarified. They are here only to learn the language.
What if we require them to act as warriors?
That brought me up short. Why? I asked. Are you at war? She shook her head.
No, but there has been some concern in the village about maybe raids from boat thugs who have been using the Dive estuary to get to the interior from the seacoast. If these young men could protect the village, this would make them more attractive guests.
I can't promise protection, I said, since there's no guarantee they'll be here if such an attack happens. But you must surely agree that having a strong young man around is better than not. Tira shrugged.
It's not bad, she said. Not as good as a strong young woman, though.
Over the course of the next few minutes, I could see her warming to the idea, and eventually, without actually having said yes, it was clear she was amenable. How might you vouch for these visitors? I asked. Their presence will be noticed in the village. Tira shrugged and gave a dismissive wave of her hand, a sort of early medieval variant of Ersebet's body language, now I think of it, and said,
That is easy. Much trade across the channel. There is nothing strange about cousins, friends of friends, and that sort, showing up from Britain and Ireland. I shall say my guests are such people, from such places.
A few minutes more conversation, and she was willing to actually speak the words,
Yes, I will take them,
which put my fledgling inner bureaucrat at ease. She even invited me to share her meal of rabbit stew with root vegetables, and to stay the night before she homed me the following morning. Back at Dodo HQ, I delivered my good news. Tristan and I sat at the same computer. Be still my heart, I suppose, to pore over the feudal, judicial, and church chronicles of the area, seeking references to raids circa 1045. We found nothing, except one possible indirect reference to villagers who perished during altercations with bandits. It did not match Tira's description, nor was it chronicled officially anywhere. It was an ancillary comment in testimony given during a property dispute.
Well, that's good anyhow, said Tristan. Probably means I won't encounter anything while I'm there.
I entered notes about Tira's dialect into the relevant linguistic databases and sat with Dorkcad personnel, giving them sketches of the area for entry into their systems. There was some chatter about timing, conducted over Odin, and occasionally in person, since we tried to dine with the Odas every couple of weeks. To make a long logistical issue short, it was determined that Tristan would go back to stay with Tira four different times, for a fortnight each time, rather than going back twice for a month each. Frank Oda determined this to be stabler with chronotron calculations, and Ersebet agreed with him. Tristan already knew Anglo-Saxon, and I'd been prepping him on Latin almost since we met. How can anyone with Western language interests not know Latin, for fuck's sake? Not know Latin. So he needed very little prep. Ersebet sent him. Tira had secured clothes in anticipation of his coming. He was sent in spring. Tira had also already communicated to curious villagers, priests, etc., that Tristan, her supposed kinsman, would be sojourning with her for a fortnight so they might exchange news, and that he was of mixed Danish-Anglo-Saxon descent, originating from a remote part of England. Tintagel, or as they called it then, Dintagel, journeying to Normandy to seek his fortune on the tourney field. This would explain why his accent was unfamiliar, and why he tended to use Britannic, Cornish, and Anglo-Saxon vocabulary. Since no one in the settlement had been to that part of England, they accepted the cover story. I know that in the bowels of Odin, there is an official deed report of Tristan's time there, for I wrote it myself. I know also that there is an incident report that the well-intentioned but insufferably officious Macy Stoll required him to write as well. But I have just come into an extra measure of whale oil, and there is ink enough, and I cannot sleep from my growing anxiety. So it pleases me to recall Tristan's telling me of his time there, and one element in particular. When he arrived, he was made welcome by the settlement at large, and all manner of gifts and entertainment pressed upon him. Once a level of trust was established, he asked to learn their combat styles, and the men of the settlement were pleased to show off and practice with him. It was generally limited to stick fighting arts, as the locals were rural villagers. These sessions also allowed him to work on language immersion more fluidly, imitating not only the vocabulary, but the cadence and pitch of able-bodied young males. He was not in danger of talking like a girl, which would have been the case if he'd mostly stayed under Tira's roof. He was homed after 2 weeks. Yes, it was dreadfully good to see him. And yes, I did try to catch a peek of him before he disappeared into the decontamination shower. After about 10 days of downtime, he went back. Another 2 weeks, another 10 days. A third fortnight, a third rest period. During the rest periods, he was fully debriefed, usually by me, and all lessons learned were inserted into Dork's linguistic database, so that future Varangian guard candidates could bone up on their Norman prior to visiting Tira, and learn the language that much more quickly. Then came the fourth and final repetition. This is the part I most like to remember him describing. One morning, shortly before dawn, Tristan and Tira were awakened by suspicious noises. Tristan arose, went outside, and saw a longboat moving up the tributary toward the village center, with 6 men in it. He grabbed a peeled tree branch, at least 1 inch thick and about his own height, which he had been intending to use to build Tira a drying rack. He ran to the village, entered the church through its narthex, and rang the bell urgently to alert the villagers. And then he stayed in the church, realizing the strangers must be coming there to steal the only thing of value in the area, a reliquary of a wrought silver cross, about a hand span across. Embedded in a decorative gold rosette in the center was a flake of white enamel, alleged by local clerics to be a fragment of a molar formerly belonging to Saint Septimus of Pontchardon, an early missionary who had been martyred by the Gauls. Obviously, this was of value to the would-be thieves for the metal, not the relic. They were startled by the bell as they approached the church entrance, more so because they found themselves unexpectedly face to face with a large man brandishing a stick. 3 of the men, armed with an axe, a steel-tipped lance, and a sayaxe, knife, held Tristan at bay in the narthex, while the other 3 ran up the aisle of the church to nab the reliquary, which lived on the altar. While there, they snatched up a few other odds and ends that had caught their eye. The candelabrum, the communion cup, etc. These booty carriers emerged from the church first, only to find some villagers, alerted by Tristan's ringing of the bell, waiting for them with shovels, rakes, pitchforks, and knives. These first intruders were lightly armed, but their hands were full of loot, and they were obliged to drop the valuables in order to defend themselves. The more heavily armed men, who had been menacing Tristan, came out to join the fray. The last of these was the one with the lance. He backed toward the exit of the building while keeping the weapon leveled at Tristan, then pivoted toward the open door to make a fast departure. However, the lance got hung up in the tiny doorway, in a manner reminiscent of an early 20th century slapstick film comedy, or so it always seems when Tristan is acting it out for new recruits. Seeing an opening, Tristan advanced and delivered a pool cue-style shot to the head of the lanceman, catching him by his ear with the butt of his staff. The man sagged toward the floor and dropped his weapon. Tristan grabbed the lance, but he himself was the next person to fall victim to the cramped dimensions of the doorway, as he tripped over its high threshold on the way out and sprawled across the pavement outside. It is a hoot to see him reenact this moment. The lance was lost. It was still dark, the sun not having risen yet. But in groping for it, Tristan found himself grasping a boat oar that had apparently been carried up to the site by one of the intruders, perhaps to use as a weapon. The melee was moving in the general direction of the riverbank. This was a long stone's throw from the church. The intruders struggled to fight their way through the mob of a dozen or so villagers who had been alerted by the church bell. The mob was haphazardly beating at them with farm implements, as not sure if the point was to prevent them from getting back into the church or to prevent them from escaping. Tristan collected himself from his unintentional vaudeville routine and caught up with the intruders as they were attempting to board the boat to make their getaway. By now, they had dropped all their booty, but nobody could see that in the dark yet. A villager grabbed the gunwale of the boat with both hands in a bid to prevent them from getting away, presumably with a reliquary. The axe-wielding intruder raised his weapon high, clearly with an eye toward cutting the villager's fingers off. Tristan lunged toward them, swung his oar in a wide arc, and caught the axeman in the gut, knocking the wind out of him and sending him sprawling back into the boat. At the same moment, the villager holding the gunwale did a belly flop into the river. I am trembling with suppressed mirth even now as I write this, recalling the many times I've seen it all acted out at office parties, when Tristan's had a few. The intruders got away in their longboat. Five of the villagers sustained very superficial wounds. Tira healed them in an hour, and Tristan strained ligaments in his shoulder when he slammed the oar into the axeman. It was nothing serious, but as I said, Macy Stoll ordered him to write an incident report about it. And this was before Dodo's bureaucracy had bloated up out of control. I wonder what would happen if he did that now. Well, I'll never know. Get used to it, Stokes. Once the sun rose, all of the artifacts were recovered, cleaned, and restored to the church. And the village had a shared breakfast, during which the children imitated the more absurd physical moments of the brief raid. What could have been a tragedy was transformed into a playful morning. But if I told you the consequences of this minor skirmish, reader, you would absolutely not believe me.
Post by Macy Stoll to Lieutenant Colonel Tristan Lyons on Private Odin Channel, 15-32-37. Day 872, mid-December, Year 2.
Lieutenant Colonel Lyons, as a rule, I don't keep tabs on all of the after-action reports on the various deeds, since Diachronic Operations is your department and not mine. Medical benefits, however, are my department. In that vein, I note that you consulted an external physician upon the conclusion of your most recent visit to the 1045 Normandy DTAP. In order for this expense to be approved, I'll need details on the nature of the injury, whether it was sustained on the job, and why Dodo medical staff were unable to deal with the problem in-house.
Response from Lieutenant Colonel Lyons.
Never mind, I will just eat the expense.
From Macy Stoll.
Your selflessness sets a brave example, but it's not just about the money. By tracking these incidents and expenditures, we are able to optimize the planning and budgeting process, unlocking the ability to hire additional medical staff to meet the needs of our growing organization. Also, for legal reasons, we need thorough documentation of all on-the-job injuries.
From Lieutenant Colonel Lyons.
I came back with a tweaked shoulder. Dr. Srinivasan checked me out and suggested I consult a physical therapist to get it worked on. The PT doc did some myofascial work and sent me home with some exercises. Everything is fine now. To the extent that this is relevant to budget and staffing, we might benefit from having a physical therapist in the medical section.
From Macy Stoll.
Thank you for the explanation. I still need to know whether the shoulder injury was contracted in the workplace.
From Lieutenant Colonel Lyons.
If by workplace you mean Normandy 1,000 years ago, yes.
From Macy Stoll.
Thank you for that additional clarification. Given the unusual nature of Dodo, That does indeed constitute a workplace injury. As such, you are required to file an incident report cross-linked to Dr. Srinivasan's outside medical specialist referral paperwork.
From Dr. Roger Blevins to Lieutenant Colonel Tristan Lyons, CC Lieutenant General Octavian K. Frank, Day 874.
Lieutenant Colonel Lyons, I am in receipt of an incident report filed yesterday describing events that took place during one of your deeds in Normandy in 1045. The account is sketchy and appears to have been written in haste, or perhaps you are simply accustomed to taking a casual attitude toward such matters. In any case, if this document is to be believed, you voluntarily engaged one or more historicals in potentially lethal combat during this deed. For the benefit of Lieutenant General Frink, CC'd for the record, this deed was strictly for the purpose of gaining fluency in the local language. It did not call for a fighter-class doer, and engaging in combat was not part of the mission scope. During the unscheduled and unauthorized tussle, you sustained injuries that later required expenditure of Dodo funds on an outside medical specialist lacking security clearance, with possible risk of exposure of top-secret information. Please consider this a formal reprimand. As the head of the operational wing of Dodo, you set an example for the ever-expanding staff of doers who serve under you, and as such, you must be held to a higher standard of professionalism and conduct than you exhibited in this case. While this is technically grounds for being placed on a performance enhancement plan, or even outright dismissal, I am willing to make an exception just this once. Please consider yourself on notice, however, that further such lapses in judgment will be treated with the utmost gravity. With that disagreeable task out of the way, I would like to consider the matter closed and wish you the best returns of the season. Sincerely, Roger Blevins, Ph.D., Director, Department of Diachronic Operations.
From Lieutenant Colonel Tristan Lyons to Dr. Roger Blevins, CC Lieutenant General Octavian K. Frank, Day 875.
Dear Dr. Blevins, concerning yesterday's letter of reprimand, I would like to point out the following circumstances that may help clarify matters for you and General Frank. The injuries that I sustained consisted of a sore shoulder. The outside medical specialist is a local physical therapist. I told her that I had sustained the injury while practicing jiu-jitsu. She accepted the story. There is no risk of leakage of classified information. The potentially lethal combat consisted of swinging a boat oar into the stomach of a drunk and disorderly Norman who was about to chop off a man's fingers. To describe this as potentially lethal is about like saying that I got up this morning in Boston and took a potentially lethal train ride into work. When we go on these deeds, we have to blend in and behave as the locals expect us to behave. I was the biggest and strongest man in the village and had been practicing stick fighting with the locals for weeks. For me to have stood by passively during this disturbance would have raised more questions than taking the minimal action that I did. Merry Christmas, Lieutenant Colonel Tristan Lyons.
Annotation, handwritten by General Frank at the bottom of above letter, scanned and delivered digitally. Day 876.
Gentlemen, Xmas is 4 days away, and we should be focused on A, brotherly love, and B, turning on the chronotron at the beginning of the new year. Please consider this matter closed, with no further repercussions, and trouble me with it no more. Happy holidays, OK Frank.
Exchange of posts between Dr. Melisande Stokes and Lieutenant Colonel Tristan Lyons on Private Odin Channel. Day 879, Christmas Eve. Year 2. From Stokes.
Subject: Chinese takeout? My turn to pay, but can you get the usual and I'll reimburse? Meet at my place. Trying to get Ersebet out of here before she goes nuclear on Blevins again. I know you're on the outs with Blevins, but we should talk to him about fast-tracking another resident witch. E has stayed far longer than she agreed to. She's being a good sport, by her standards, but I'm